Vion-sur-Salt, France, July 30th, 1714. 13. A hand shakes Adeline awake. For a moment, she is out of place, out of time. Sleep clings to her edges, and with it, the dream. It must have been a dream of prayers made to silent gods, of deals made in the dark, of being forgotten. Her imagination has always been a vivid thing. "Wake up," says a voice, one she has known all her life. The hand again, firm on her shoulder, and she blinks away the last of sleep to find the wooden planks of a barn ceiling, straw pricking her skin, and Isabel kneeling beside her, blonde hair braided into a crown, brows drawn tight with worry. Her face has waned a little with every child, each birth stealing a little more of her life. "Get up, you fool!" That is what Isabel should say, the chiding softened by the kindness in her voice. But her lips are pursed with worry, her forehead furrowed with concern. She has always frowned like that, fully, with her whole face. But when Adeline reaches out to press one thumb into the space between the other girl's brows, to smooth away the worry, the way she has a thousand times before, Isabel draws back, away from the touch of a stranger. Not a dream, then.
"Mathieu?"
Isabel calls over her shoulder, and Adeline sees her oldest son standing in the barn's open doorway, clutching a pail.
"Go and get a blanket."
The boy vanishes into the sun.
"Who are you?"
asks Isabel, and Adeline starts to answer, forgetting that the name won't come. It lodges in her throat.
"What happened to you?"
presses Isabel.
"Are you lost?"
Adeline nods.
"Where did you come from?"
"Here."
Isabel's frown deepens.
"Vion? But that's not possible. We would have met. I've lived here all my life."
"So have I,"
she murmurs, and Isabel must see the truth as a delusion because she shakes her head as if clearing away a thought.
"That boy,"
she mutters.
"Where has he gone?"
She turns her gaze fully back to Adeline.
"Can you stand?"
Arm in arm, they walk into the yard. Adeline is filthy, but Isabel doesn't let go, and her throat tightens at the simple kindness, the warmth of the other girl's touch. Isabel treats her like a wild thing, her voice soft, her motions slow as she leads Adeline to the house.
"Are you hurt?"
"Yes," she thinks, but she knows Isabel is speaking of scrapes and cuts and simple wounds, and of those she is less certain. She looks down at herself. In the darkness, the worst was hidden. In the light of morning, it's on display. Adeline's dress, spoiled. Her slippers, ruined. Her skin, painted with the forest floor. She felt the scratch and tear of brambles in the woods last night, but she can find no angry welts, no cuts, no signs of blood.
"No,"
she says softly as they step inside the house. There is no sign of Mathieu or Henri, their second child, just the baby, Sarah, sleeping in a basket by the hearth. Isabel sits Adeline in a chair across from the infant and sets a pot of water over the fire.
"You're being so kind,"
Adeline whispers.
"I was a stranger and you welcomed me,"
says Isabel. It is a Bible verse. She brings a basin to the table, along with a cloth. Kneeling at Adeline's feet, she coaxes the dirty slippers off, sets them by the hearth, then takes Adeline's hands and begins to clean the forest floor from her fingers, the soil from beneath her nails. As she works, Isabel peppers her with questions, and Adeline tries to answer, she really does, but her name is still a shape she cannot say, and when she speaks of her life in the village, of the shadow in the woods, of the deal she made, the words make it across her lips, but stop before they reach the other girl's ears. Isabel's face goes blank, her gaze flat, and when Adeline finally trails off, she gives her head a quick shake, as if throwing off a daydream.
"Sorry,"
says her oldest friend with an apologetic smile.
"What were you saying?"
She will learn in time that she can lie, and the words will flow like wine, easily poured, easily swallowed. But the truth, will always stop at the end of her tongue, her story silenced for all but herself. A mug is pressed into Adeline's hands as the infant begins to fuss.
It is an hour's ride to the nearest village, Isabel says, lifting the swaddled child. Did you walk all this way? You must have.
She is speaking to Adeline, of course, but her voice is soft, sweet, her attention on Sarah, breathing into the soft down of the baby's hair, and Adeline must admit her friend was seemingly made to be a mother, too content to even notice the attention.
What will we do with you?
She coos. Footsteps sound on the path outside, heavy and booted, and Isabel straightens a little, patting the infant's back.
That will be my husband, Georges.
Adeline knows Georges well, had kissed him once when they were six, back when kisses were traded like pieces in a game. But now her heart flutters with panic, and she is already on her feet, the cup clattering to the table. It is not Georges she fears. It is the doorway, and what happens when Isabel is on the other side. She catches Isabel's arm, her grip sudden and tight, and for the first time, fear flits across the other woman's face. But then she steadies and pats Adeline's hand.
Don't worry, she says. I'll talk to him. It will all be well.
And before Adeline can refuse, the infant is pressed into her arms and Isabel is out of reach.
Wait, please.
Fear beats inside her chest, but Isabel is gone. The door stays open, voices rising and falling in the yard beyond, the words themselves reduced to windsong. The infant murmurs in her arms, and she sways a little, trying to soothe the child and herself. The baby quiets, and she's just returning her to the basket when she hears a short gasp.
Get away from her!
It is Isabel, her voice high and tight with panic.
Who let you in?
All the Christian kindness erased in an instant by a mother's fear.
You did,
says Adeline, and she has to fight the urge to laugh. There is no humor in the moment, only madness. Isabel stares in horror.
You're lying,
she says, surging forward, halted only by her husband's hand upon her shoulder. He has seen Adeline too, marked her as a different kind of wild thing, a wolf inside their house.
I meant no harm, she says.
Then go,
orders Georges. And what else can she do? She abandons the baby, leaves behind the mug of broth, the basin on the table, and her oldest friend. She hurries out into the yard and glances back, sees Isabel press her daughter to her chest before Georges blocks the doorway, axe in hand as if she is a tree to fell, a shadow set upon their house. And then he too is gone, and the door is shut and bolted. Adeline stands on the path, uncertain what to do, where to go. There are grooves in her mind, worn smooth and deep. Her legs have carried her to and from this place too many times. Her body knows the way. Go down this road and take a left, and there is her own house, which is not her home anymore, even though her feet are already moving toward it. Her feet. Adeline shakes her head. She left her slippers by Isabel's hearth to dry. A pair of Georges' boots lean against the wall beside the door, and she takes them and begins to walk, not to the house she grew up in, but back to the river where her prayers began. The day is already warm, the air edged with heat as she drops the boots onto the bank and steps out into the shallow stream. Her breath catches with the cold as the river laps up around her calves, kisses the backs of her knees. She looks down, seeking out her warped reflection, and half expects to not find it there, to see only the sky behind her head. But she is still there, distorted by the stream. Hair once braided, now wild, sharp eyes wide, seven freckles like flecks of paint across her skin, a face drawn in fear and anger.
Why didn't you answer?
She hisses to the sunlight on the stream. But the river only laughs in its soft, slippery way, the burble of water over stone. She wrestles with the laces of her wedding dress, peels the soiled thing away, plunges it down into the water.
The current drags at the fabric, and her fingers long to let go, to let the river claim this last vestige of her life, but she has too little now to give up more. Adeline plunges herself in too, freeing the last flowers from her hair, rinsing the woods from her skin. She comes up feeling cold and brittle and new. The sun is high, the day hot, and she lays the dress out in the grass to dry, sinks onto the slope beside it in her shift. They sit side by side in silence, one a ghost of the other. And she realizes, looking down, that this is all she has. A dress, a slip, a pair of stolen shoes. Restless, she takes up a stick and begins to draw absent patterns in the silt along the bank, but every stroke she makes dissolves, the change too quick to be the river's doing. She draws a line, watches it begin to wash away before she even finishes the mark, tries to write her name, but her hand stills, pinned under the same rock that held her tongue. She carves a deeper line, gouges out the sand, but it makes no difference. Soon that groove is gone too, and an angry sob escapes her throat as she casts the stick away. Tears prick her eyes as she hears the shuffle of small feet, blinks to find a round-faced boy standing over her. Isabel's 4-year-old son. Addie used to swing him in her arms, spin until they both were dizzy and laughing.
"Hello,"
says the boy. "Hello," she says, her voice a little shaky.
"Henri,"
calls the boy's mother, and in a moment, Isabel is there, on the rise, a basket of washing on her hip. She sees Adeline sitting in the grass, holds out a hand not for her friend, but for her son. "Come here," she orders, those blue eyes lingering on Adeline.
"Who are you?"
asks Isabel. And she feels as if she's at the edge of a steep hill, the ground plunging away beneath her feet, her balance tipping forward as the dreaded descent begins again.
"Are you lost?"
"Déjà vu, déjà su, déjà vécu."
Already seen, already known, already lived. They have been here before. Walked this road, or something like it, and so Adeline now knows where to put her feet, knows what to say, which words will draw out kindness, knows that if she asks in the right way, Isabel will take her home and wrap a blanket around her shoulders and offer her a cup of broth, and it will work until it doesn't.
"No,"
she says.
"I'm just passing through."
It is the wrong thing to say, and Isabel's expression hardens.
"It is not fitting for a woman to travel alone, and certainly not in such a state."
"I know," she says.
"I had more, but I was robbed."
Isabel blanches.
"By who?"
"A stranger in the woods,"
she says, and it is not a lie.
"Are you hurt?"
"Yes," she thinks, grievously, but she forces herself to shake her head and answer,
"I will live."
She has no choice. The other woman sets the washing down.
"Wait here,"
says Isabel, the kind and generous Isabel again.
"I will come right back."
She swings her young son up in her arms and turns back toward her house, and the moment she is out of sight, Adeline gathers her dress, still damp at the hem, and pulls it on. Isabel will, of course, forget again. She'll get halfway to her house before she slows and wonders why she started back without her clothes. She'll blame her tired mind, addled from 3 children, the infant's distemper, and return to the river. And this time, there will be no woman sitting on the banks, no dress spread in the sun, only a stick abandoned in the grass, a canvas of silt laid smooth. Adeline has drawn her family house 100 times. Memorized the angle of the roof, the texture of the door, the shadow of her father's workshop, and the limbs of the old yew tree that sits like a sentinel at the edge of the yard. That is where she's standing now, tucked behind the trunk, watching Maxime graze beside the barn, watching her mother hang linens out to dry, watching her father whittle down a block of wood. And as Adeline watches, she realizes she cannot stay. Or rather, she could, could find a way to skip from house to house like stones skating across the river, but she will not. Because when she thinks of it, she feels neither like the river nor the stone, but like a hand as it tires of throwing. There is Estelle closing her door. There is Isabel, one moment kind and the next filled with horror. Later, much later, Addie will make a game of these cycles. We'll see how long she can step from perch to perch before she falls. But right now, the pain is too fresh, too sharp, and she cannot fathom going through those motions, cannot weather the weary look on her father's face, the rebuke in Estelle's eyes. Adeline LaRue cannot be a stranger here to these people she has always known. It hurts too much watching them forget her. Her mother slips back inside the house, and Adeline abandons the shelter of the tree and starts across the yard, not for the front door, but for her father's shop. There is a single shuttered window, an unlit lamp, the only light a stripe of sun spilling through the open door, but that is enough to see by. She knows the contours of this place by heart. The air smells like sap, earthy and sweet. The floor is covered in shavings and dust, and every surface holds the bounty of her father's work. A wooden horse, modeled from Maxime, of course, but here no bigger than a cat. A set of bowls, decorated only by the rings of the trunk from which they were cut. A collection of palm-sized birds, their wings spread, or folded, or stretched mid-flight. Adeline learned to sketch the world in charcoal and pressed lead, but her father has always created with a knife, whittled the shapes out of nothing, giving them breadth and depth and life. She reaches out now and runs her finger down the horse's nose the way she has 100 times before. What is she doing here? Adeline does not know. Saying goodbye, perhaps, to her father, her favorite person in this world. That is how she would remember him, not by the sad unknowing in his eyes or the grim set of his jaw as he led her to church, but by the things he loved, by the way he showed her how to hold a stick of charcoal, coaxing shapes and shades with the weight of her hand. The songs and stories, the sights from the 5 summers she went with him to market, when Adeline was old enough to travel, but not old enough to cause a stir. By the careful gift of a wooden ring made for his first and only daughter when she was born, the one she then offered to the dark. Even now, her hand drifts to her throat to thumb the leather cord, and something deep inside her cringes when she remembers it is gone forever. Scraps of parchment scatter the table, covered in drawings and dimensions, the markings of past and future work. A pencil sits on the edge of the desk, and Adeline finds herself reaching for it, even as a dread echo sounds inside her chest. She brings it to the page and begins to write. Cher Papa. But as the pencil scratches across the paper, the letters fade in its wake. By the time Adeline has finished those 2 unsteady words, they are gone, and when she slams her hand down on the table, she upsets a tiny pot of varnish, spilling the precious oil onto her father's notes, the wood beneath. She scrambles to collect the papers, staining her hands and knocking over one of the little wooden birds. But there is no need for panic. The varnish is already soaking through, sinking in and down like a rock in a river until it's gone. It is such a strange thing to make sense of this moment, to count what has and hasn't been lost. The varnish is gone, but not back into the pot, which lies empty on its side, the contents lost. The parchment lies unmarked, untouched, as is the table beneath. Only her hands are stained, the oil tracing the whorls of her fingers, the lines of her palms. She is still staring at them when she steps back and hears the terrible snap of wood splitting beneath her heel. It is the little wooden bird, one of its wings splintered on the packed earth floor. Adeline winces in sympathy. It was her favorite of the flock, frozen in a moment of upward motion, the first rise of flight. She crouches to gather it up, but by the time she straightens, the splinters on the ground are gone. and in her hand, the little wooden bird is whole again. She nearly drops it in surprise, doesn't know why this is the thing that seems impossible. She has been made a stranger, has seen herself slide from the minds of those she's known and loved like the sun behind a cloud, has watched every mark she tries to make as it's undone, erased. But the bird is different. Perhaps because she can hold it in her hands. Perhaps because, for an instant, it seems a blessing, this undoing of an accident, a righting of a wrong, and not simply an extension of her own erasure, the inability to leave a mark. But Adeline doesn't think of it that way, not yet, has not spent months turning the curse over in her hands, memorizing its shape, studying the smooth surfaces in search of cracks. In this moment, she simply clutches the small, unbroken bird, grateful that it's safe. She is about to return the figure to its flock when something stops her. Perhaps the oddness of the moment, perhaps the fact that she is already missing this life, even if it will never miss her. But she tucks the bird into the pocket of her skirts and forces herself out of the shed and away from her home. Down the road, and past the twisted yew tree and around the bend until she has reached the edge of town. Only then does she let herself look back, let her gaze drift one last time to the line of trees across the field, the dense shadow stretched beneath the sun, before she turns her back on the forest and the village of Villon and the life that is no longer hers, and begins to walk. Villon-sur-Sarthe, France, July 30th, 1714. 14. Villon vanishes like a cart around a bend, the rooftops swallowed up by the trees and the hills of the surrounding country. By the time Adeline musters the courage to look back, it is gone. She sighs and turns and walks, wincing at the strange shape of Georges' boots. They are too large by half. Adeline found socks on a washing line, shoved them into the toes of the shoes to make them fit, but by the fourth hour of walking, she can feel the places where her skin has rubbed raw, the blood pooling in the leather soles. She is afraid to look, and so she doesn't, focuses only on the path ahead. She has decided to walk toward the walled city of Le Mans. It is the farthest she has ever gone, and even still, she has never made the trip alone. She knows the world is so much larger than the towns along the Sarthe, but right now she cannot think beyond the road in front of her. Every step she takes is a step away from Villon, away from a life that is no longer hers. "You wanted to be free," says a voice in her head, but it is not hers. No, it is deeper, smoother, lined with satin and wood smoke. She skirts the villages, the farms alone in their fields. There are whole stretches when the world seems to empty around her, as if an artist drew the barest lines of the landscape, then turned, distracted from the task. Once, Adeline hears a cart trundling down the road and ducks into the shade of a nearby grove and waits for it to pass. She does not want to stray too far from the road or the river, but over her shoulder, through a copse of trees, she sees the yellow blush of summer fruit and her stomach aches with longing. An orchard. The shade is lovely, the air cool, and she picks a ripened peach from a low branch and sinks her teeth greedily into the fruit, her empty stomach cramping around the sugared bite. Despite the pain, she eats a pear as well, and a handful of mirabelles, scoops palm after palm of water from a well at the orchard's edge, before forcing herself forward, out of the shelter, and back into the summer heat. The shadows are stretching long when she finally sinks onto the riverbank and pulls off the boots to assess the damage to her feet. But there is none. The socks are unbloody, her heels uncut. No sign of the miles walked, the wear and tear of so many hours on the packed earth road, though she felt the pain of every step. Nor are her shoulders burned from the sun, though all day she felt its heat. Her stomach twists, aching for something more than stolen fruit, but as the light ebbs and the hills darken, there are no lanterns, no homes in sight. Exhausted, she would curl up right there on the river's edge and give in to sleep, but insects float above the water, nipping at her skin, and so she retreats into an open field and sinks down amid the tall grass the way she did so many times when she was young and wanted to be somewhere else. The grass would swallow the house, the workshop, the rooftops of Vion, everything except the open sky overhead, a sky that could belong to anywhere. Now, as she stares up at the mottled dusk, she longs for home. Not for Roger or the future she did not want, but the woody grip of Estelle's hand on hers as the old woman showed her how to wind raspberry bushes, and the soft hum of her father's voice as he worked in his shed, the scent of sap and wood dust in the air, the pieces of her life she never meant to lose. She slips her hand into the pocket of her skirt, fingers searching for the little carved bird. She has not let herself reach for it before, half sure it would be gone, its theft undone like every other act. But it is still there, the wood smooth and warm. Adeline draws it out, holds it up against the sky, and wonders. She could not break the figurine, but she could take it. Amid the growing list of negatives, she cannot write, cannot say her name, cannot leave a mark, this is the first thing she has been able to do. She can steal. It will be a long time before she knows the contours of her curse, longer still before she understands the shadow's sense of humor, before he looks at her over a glass of wine and observes that a successful theft is an anonymous act, the absence of a mark. In this moment, she is simply grateful for the talisman. My name is Adeline Larue, she tells herself, clutching the little wooden bird. I was born in Vion in the year 1691 to Jean and Marthe in a stone house just beyond the old yew tree. She tells the story of her life to the little carving, as if afraid she'll forget herself as easily as others do, unaware that her mind is now a flawless cage, her memory a perfect trap. She will never forget, though she'll wish she could. As the night creeps through, purple giving way to black, Adeline looks up into the dark and begins to suspect that the dark is staring back, that god or demon with its cruel gaze, its mocking smile, features contorted in a way she never drew. As she stares, head craned, the stars seem to pick out the lines of a face, the cheekbones and brow, the illusion drawing together until she half expects the blanket of night to ripple and twist as the shadows did in the woods, the space between stars splitting to reveal those emerald eyes. She bites her tongue to keep from calling to him, lest something else decide to answer. She is not in Vion, after all. She does not know which gods might linger here. Later, her strength will falter. Later, there will be nights when her need will smother caution, and she will scream and curse and dare him to come out and face her. Later. But tonight, she is tired and hungry and loath to waste what little energy she has on gods that will not answer. So she curls onto her side, squeezes her eyes shut, and waits for sleep. And as she does, she thinks of torches in the field beyond the woods, of voices calling her name. Adeline, Adeline, Adeline. The words pound against her, drumming on her skin like rain. She wakes sometime later with a start, the world inky black and the downpour already soaking through her dress, the rainstorm sudden and heavy. She hurries, skirts dragging, across the field to the nearest line of trees. Back home, she loved the patter of rain against the walls of the house, used to lie awake and listen to the world washed clean. But here, she has no bed, no shelter. She does her best to wring the water from the dress, but it is already cooling on her skin, and she huddles among the roots, shivering beneath the broken canopy. My name is Adeline Larue, she tells herself. My father taught me how to be a dreamer, and my mother taught me how to be a wife, and Estelle taught me how to speak to gods. Her thoughts drag on Estelle, who used to stand out in the rain, palms open as if to catch the storm. Estelle,
who never cared as much for the company of others as for her own, who probably would have been content to be alone in the world. She tries to imagine what the old woman would say if she could see her now, but every time she tries to summon those keen eyes, that knowing mouth, she sees only the way Estelle looked at her in those last moments, the way her face furrowed and then cleared, a lifetime of knowing brushed away like a tear. No, she should not think of Estelle. Adeline wraps her arms around her knees and tries to sleep, and when she wakes again, sunlight is pouring through the trees. A finch stands on the mossy ground nearby, pecking at the hem of her dress. She brushes it away, checking her pocket for the little wooden bird as she stands, sways, dizzy with hunger, realizes she has not had more than fruit in a day and a half. My name is Adeline LaRue, she tells herself as she makes her way back to the road. It is becoming a mantra, something to pass the time, measure her steps, and she repeats it over and over. She rounds a bend and stops, blinking fiercely as if the sun is in her eyes. It's not, and yet the world ahead has been plunged into a sudden, vivid yellow, the green fields devoured by a blanket the color of egg yolk. She looks back over her shoulder, but the way behind her is still green and brown, the ordinary shades of summer. The field ahead is mustard seed, though she doesn't know it then. Then it is simply beautiful in an overpowering way. Addie stares, and for a moment she forgets her hunger, her aching feet, her sudden loss, and marvels at the shocking brightness, the all-consuming color. She wades through the field, flower buds brushing her palms, unafraid to crush the plants underfoot. They have already straightened in her wake, steps erased. By the time she reaches the far edge of the field, and the path, and the steady green, it looks dull, her eyes searching for another source of wonder. Shortly after, a larger town comes into sight, and she is about to weave around it when she catches a scent on the air that makes her stomach ache. Butter, yeast, the sweet and hearty smell of bread. She looks like a dress that fell from the line, wrinkled and dirty, her hair a tangled nest, but she is too hungry to care. She follows the scent between the houses and up a narrow lane toward the village square. Voices rise with the smell of baking, and when she rounds the corner, she sees a handful of women sitting around a communal oven. They perch on the stone bench around it, laughing and chatting like birds on a branch as the loaves rise within the oven's open mouth. The sight of them is jarring, ordinary in an aching way, and Adeline lingers in the shaded lane a moment, listening to the trill and chirp of their voices before the hunger forces her forward. She doesn't have to search her pockets to know she has no coins. Perhaps she could barter for the bread, but all she has is the bird, and when she finds it in the folds of her skirt, her fingers refuse to loosen on the wood. She could beg, but her mother's face comes to mind, eyes tight with scorn. That leaves only theft, which is wrong, of course, but she is too hungry to weigh the sin of it. There is only the matter of how. The oven is hardly unmanned, and despite how fast she seems to fade from memory, she is still flesh and blood, not phantom. She cannot simply walk up and take the bread without causing a stir. Sure, they might forget her soon enough, but what danger would she be in before they did? If she got to the bread and then away, how far would she have to run? How fast? And then she hears it, a soft animal sound, almost lost beneath the chatter. She circles the stone hut and finds her chance across the lane. A mule stands in the shade, lazily chewing its bit beside a sack of apples, a stack of kindling. All it takes is a single sharp smack, and the mule lurches, more in shock, she hopes, than pain. It jostles forward, upsetting the apples and the wood as it sets off. And just like that, the square is startled, thrown into a brief but noisy state as the beast trots away, dragging a bag of grain, and the women leap to their feet, the trills and warbles of their laughs dissolving into taut shouts of dismay.
Adeline slips across the oven like a cloud, swiping the nearest loaf from the stone mouth. Pain sears across her fingers as she grabs it, and she nearly drops the bread, but she is too hungry, and pain, she is learning, doesn't last. The loaf is hers, and by the time the mule is settled and the grain set right and the apples gathered and the women return to their place by the oven, she is already gone. She leans in the shade of a stable on the edge of town, teeth tearing into the underbaked bread. The dough collapses in her mouth, heavy, sweet, and hard to swallow, but she doesn't care. It is filling enough, wearing the edges off her hunger. Her mind begins to clear. Her chest loosens, and for the first time since she left Vion, she feels something like human, if not whole. She pushes off the stable wall and begins to walk again, following the line of the sun and the path of the river toward Le Mans. "My name is Adeline," she starts again, then stops. She never loved the name, and now she cannot even say it. Whatever she calls herself, it will be only in her head. Adeline is the woman she left in Vion on the eve of a wedding she did not want. But Addie was a gift from Estelle, shorter, sharper, the switch-quick name for the girl who rode to markets and strained to see over roofs, for the one who drew and dreamed of bigger stories, grander worlds, of lives filled with adventure. And so, as she walks on, she starts the story over in her head. "My name is Addie LaRue." New York City, March 11th, 2014. 15. It is too quiet without James. Addie never thought of him as loud, charming, cheerful, but hardly raucous. But now she realizes how much he filled this space when they were in it. That night, he put on a record and sang along as he made grilled cheese on the 6-burner stove, which they ate standing up because the place was new and he hadn't bought kitchen chairs. There are still no kitchen chairs, but now there is no James either. He's off on location somewhere, and the apartment stretches out around her, too silent and too large for one person, the high floor and the double-paned glass combining to block out the sounds of the city, reducing Manhattan to a picture, still and gray, beyond the windows. Addie plays record after record, but the sound only echoes. She tries to watch TV, but the drone of news is more static than anything, as is the tinny choir of voices on the radio, too far away to feel real. The sky outside is a static gray, a thin mist of rain blurring the buildings. It is the kind of day designed for wood fires and mugs of tea and well-loved books. But while James has a fireplace, it's only gas, and when she checks the cupboard for her favorite blend, she finds the box nestled at the back, but it is empty, and all the books he keeps are histories, not fiction, and Addie knows she cannot pass the day here with only herself for company. She gets dressed again, in her own clothes, and smooths the covers back onto the bed, even though the cleaners will surely return before James does. With a last glance at the dreary day, she steals a scarf from a closet shelf, a soft plaid cashmere with the tag still on, and sets out, the lock chiming behind her. She does not know, at first, where she is going. Some days, she still feels like a lion caged, pacing its enclosure. Her feet have a mind of their own, and soon they are carrying her uptown. "My name is Addie LaRue," she thinks to herself as she walks. 300 years, and some part of her is still afraid of forgetting. There have been times, of course, when she wished her memory more fickle, when she would have given anything to welcome madness and disappear. It is the kinder road to lose yourself. Like Peter in J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan. There at the end, when Peter sits on the rock, the memory of Wendy Darling sliding from his mind, and it is sad, of course, to forget, but it is a lonely thing to be forgotten. To remember when no one else does. "I remember," whispers the darkness, almost kindly, as if he's not the one who cursed her. Perhaps it is the bad weather, or perhaps it is this maudlin mood that leads Addie up along the eastern edge of Central Park to 82nd and into the granite halls of the Met. Addie has always had a fondness for museums, spaces where history gathers out of place, where art is ordered and artifacts sit on pedestals or hang on walls above little white didactics. Addie feels like a museum sometimes, one only she can visit. She crosses the Great Hall, with its stone arches and colonnades, weaves her way through Greco-Roman and past Oceana, exhibits she has lingered in 100 times, continues until she reaches the European Sculpture Court with its grand marble figures. One room over, she finds it, where it always is. It sits in a glass case along one wall, framed on either side by pieces made of iron or silver. It is not large, as far as sculptures go, the length of her arm from elbow to fingertips. A wooden plinth with 5 marble birds perched atop it, each about to fly away. It is the 5th that holds her gaze, the lift of its beak, the angle of its wings, the soft down of its feathers captured once in wood and now in stone. Revenir, it's called, to come back. Addie remembers the first time she found the work, the small miracle of it, sitting there on its clean white block. The artist, Arlo Muret, a man she never knew, never met, and yet here he is with a piece of her story, her past, found and made into something memorable, something worthwhile, something beautiful. She wishes she could touch the little bird, run her finger along its wing the way she always did, even though she knows it's not the one she lost, knows this one wasn't carved by her father's strong hands but by a stranger. Still, it is there. It is real. It is, in some way, hers. A secret kept. A record made. The first mark she left upon the world, long before she knew the truth, that ideas are so much wilder than memories, that they long and look for ways of taking root. Le Mans, France, July 31st, 1714. 16. Le Mans lies like a sleeping giant in the fields along the Sarthe. It has been more than 10 years since Addie was allowed to make the trek to the walled city, perched beside her father in the family cart. Now, her heart quickens as she steps through the city gates. There is no horse this time, no father, no cart, but in the late afternoon light, the city is just as busy, just as bustling as she remembered. Addie doesn't bother trying to blend in. If now and then someone glances her way, notices the young woman in the stained white dress, they keep their opinions to themselves. It is easier to be alone among so many people. Only, she doesn't know where to go. She pauses a moment to think, only to hear hooves clattering, too sudden and too close, and narrowly escapes being trampled by a cart.
Out of the way,
shouts the driver as she lunges back, only to collide with a woman carrying a basket of pears. It tips, spilling 3 or 4 onto the cobbled path.
Watch where you're going, snarls the woman.
But when Addie bends to help her fetch the fallen fruit, the woman screeches and stomps at her fingers. Addie backs away and thrusts her hands into her pockets, clings to the little wooden bird as she continues through the winding streets toward the center of the city. There are so many roads, but they all look the same. She thought this place would feel more familiar, but it only feels strange, a figment from a long-ago dream. When Addie was last here, the city seemed a wonder, a grand and vital place, the bustling markets bathed in sun, the voices ringing off of stone, her father's broad shoulders blocking out the city's darker sides. But now, alone, a menace has crept in like fog, erasing the buoyant charm, leaving only the sharp edges jutting through the mist, one version of the city replaced by another. palimpsest. She doesn't know the word just yet, but 50 years from now, in a Paris salon, she will hear it for the first time. The idea of the past blotted out, written over by the present, and think of this moment in Le Mans. A place she knows and yet doesn't. How foolish to think it would stay the same when everything else has changed, when she has changed, grown from a girl into a woman and then into this, a phantom, a ghost. She swallows hard and stands up straight, determined not to fray or fall apart. But Addie cannot find the inn where she and her father stayed, and even if she could, what did she plan to do there? She has no way to pay, and even if she had the coin, who would rent to a woman on her own? Le Mans is a city, but it is not so big that such a thing would pass beneath a landlord's notice. Addie's grip tightens on the carving in her skirts as she continues through the streets. There is a market just past the town hall, but it's closing up, tables empty, the carts pulling away, the ground littered only with the dregs of lettuce and a few moldy potatoes. And before she can think of scrounging for them, they are gone, swept away by smaller, quicker hands. There is a tavern inn at the edge of the square. She watches a man dismount his horse, a dappled mare, and pass the reins to a stable hand, already turning toward the noise and hustle of the open doors. She watches the stable hand lead the mare across the way to a broad wooden barn and vanish into the relative dark. But it's not the barn that's caught her eye, or the horse. It's the pack still thrown across its back, two heavy satchels bulging like sacks of grain. Addie crosses the square and slips into the stable behind the man and the mare, her steps as light and quick as possible. Sunlight streams weakly through the beams in the stable roof, casting the place in soft relief, a few highlights amid the layered shadow, the kind of place she would have loved to draw. A dozen horses shuffle in their stalls, and across the barn, the stable hand hums to the mare as he strips away its tack, tosses the saddle over the wooden divide, and brushes down the beast, his own hair a nest of knots and snarls. Addie ducks low, creeping toward the stalls at the back of the barn, the sacks and satchels strewn on the wooden barriers between the horses. Her hands dart hungrily across the trappings, searching beneath buckles and under flaps. There are no purses, but she finds a heavy riding coat, a skin of wine, a boning knife the length of her hand. The coat she drapes around her shoulders. The blade goes into one deep pocket and the wine in the other as she creeps on, quiet as a ghost. She doesn't see the empty bucket until her shoe cracks against it with a sharp clatter. It falls with a muffled thud onto the hay, and Addie holds her breath and hopes the sound is lost among the shuffling hooves. But the stable hand stops humming. She sinks lower, folds herself into the shadows of the nearest stall. 5 seconds pass, then 10, and then at last the humming starts again, and Addie straightens and makes her way to the final stall, where a stout draft horse lounges, munching grain, beside a belted bag. Her fingers drift toward the buckle.
"What are you doing?"
The voice, too close behind her. The stable hand, no longer humming, no longer brushing the dappled mare, but standing in the alley between berths, a crop in his hand.
"Sorry, sir," she says, a shade breathless. "I came looking for my father's horse. He wanted something from his satchel."
He stares at her, unblinking, his features half swallowed by the dark sprawl of his hair.
"Which horse would that be?"
She wishes she'd studied the horses as well as their packs, but she cannot hesitate. It would reveal the lie, so she turns quickly toward the workhorse.
"This one."
It is a good lie, as far as lies go, the kind that could have easily been true if she'd only picked another horse. A grim smile twitches beneath the man's beard.
"Ah," he says, flicking the crop against his palm. "But you see, that one's mine."
Addie has the strange and sickening urge to laugh.
"Can I pick again?"
she whispers, inching toward the stable door.
Somewhere nearby, a mare whinnies. Another stamps its hoof. The crop stops snapping against the man's palm, and Addie lurches sideways between the stalls, the stable hand on her heels. He's fast, a speed clearly born from catching beasts, but she is lighter and has far more to lose. His hand grazes the collar of her stolen coat, but he cannot catch her. His heavy steps falter and slow, and Addie thinks she's free right before she hears the crisp, bright sound of a bell ringing on the stable wall, followed by the sound of boots coming from outside. She is nearly to the mouth of the barn when the second man appears, cutting like a wide shadow across the doorway.
"Has a beast got free?"
he shouts before he sees her, wrapped in the stolen coat, her two large boots catching on the hay. She scrambles backward, right into the arms of the stable hand. His fingers close around her shoulders, heavy as shackles, and when she tries to twist free, his grip digs deep enough to bruise.
"Caught her thieving,"
he says, the coarse bristles on his cheek scraping hers.
"Let me go,"
she pleads as he pulls her tight.
"This isn't a market stall,"
sneers the second, drawing a knife from his belt.
"Do you know what we do with thieves?"
"It was a mistake. Please, let me go."
The knife wags like a finger.
"Not until you've paid."
"I don't have any money."
"That's all right,"
says the second man, drawing closer.
"Thieves pay in flesh."
She tries to tear free, but the grip on her arms is iron as the knife comes to rest against the laces of her dress, plucking them like strings. And when she twists again, she is no longer trying to get free, simply trying to reach the boning knife inside the pocket of her stolen coat. Twice her fingers brush the wooden hilt before she manages to catch it. She drives the blade down and back into the first man's thigh, feels it sink into the meat of his leg. He cries out before he thrusts her away like a hornet, flinging her forward, right onto the other man's blade. Pain screams through her shoulder as the knife bites in, skates along her collarbone, leaving a trail of searing heat. Her mind goes blank with it, but her legs are already moving, carrying her through the stable doors and out into the square. She throws herself behind a barrel, out of sight, as the men come stumbling, swearing, out of the barn behind her, their faces twisted with rage, and something worse, something primal, hungry. And then, between one step and the next, they begin to slow. Between one step and the next, the urgency falters and fades, the purpose slipping like a thought out of reach. The men look around, and then at each other. The one she stabbed stands straighter now, no sign of the tear in his trousers, no blood soaking through the fabric. The mark she left on him, erased. They jostle and rib and head back into the barn, and Addie slumps forward, her head coming to rest against the wooden barrel. Her chest throbs, pain tracing a vivid line along her collar, and when she presses her hand to the wound, her fingers come away red. She cannot stay there, curled behind the barrel, forces herself up, and sways, feeling faint, but soon the wave of sickness passes, and she is still on her feet. She walks, one hand pressed to her shoulder and the other closed tight around the knife beneath her stolen coat. She doesn't know when she decides to leave Le Mans, but soon enough she is crossing the courtyard, away from the stable and through the winding streets, past bawdy inns and tavern houses, past crowded steps and raucous laughter, giving the city up with every step. The ache in her shoulder fades from a searing heat to a dull throb, and then to nothing. She runs her fingers over the gash, but it is gone. As is the blood on her dress, swallowed up like the words she scrawled across her father's parchment, the lines she drew in the silt on the riverbank. The only traces of it are on her skin, a crust of drying blood along her collarbone, a smear of browning red across her palm. And Addie marvels a moment, despite herself, at the strange magic of it, the proof that in one way, the shadow kept his word. Twisted it, yes, warped her wishes into something wrong and rotten, but granted her this at least, to live. A small, mad sound escapes her throat, and there is relief in it, perhaps, but also horror. For the truth of her hunger, which she is only just discovering, for the ache in her feet, though they do not cut or bruise, for the pain of the wound in her shoulder before it healed. The darkness has granted her freedom from death, perhaps, but not from this, not from suffering. It will be years before she learns the true meaning of that word, but in this moment, as she walks into the thickening dusk, she is still relieved to be alive. A relief that flickers when she reaches the edge of the city. This is as far as Adeline has ever gone. Le Mans looms at her back, and ahead the high stone walls give way to scattered towns, each one like a copse of trees, and then to open field, and then to what she does not know. When Addie was young, she would surge up the slopes that rose and fell around Vion, fling herself to the very edge of the hill, the place where the ground fell away, and stop, heart racing as her body leaned forward, longing for the fall. The slightest push and weight would do the rest. There is no steep hill beneath her now, no slope, and yet she feels her balance tilt. And then Estelle's voice rises to meet her in the dark. How do you walk to the end of the world? She once asked, and when Addie didn't know, the old woman smiled that wrinkled grin and answered, one step at a time. Addie is not going to the end of the world, but she must go somewhere, and in that moment, she decides. She is going to Paris. It is, beside Le Mans, the only city she knows by name, a place that played so many times across her stranger's lips and featured into every tale her father told, a place of gods and kings, gold and majesty and promise. This is how it starts, he would have said if he could see her now. Addie takes the first step and feels the ground give way, feels herself tip forward, but this time she does not fall. New York City, March 12, 2014. 17. It is a better day. The sun is out, the air is not so cold, and there is so much to love about a city like New York. The food, the art, the constant offerings of culture, though Addie's favorite thing is its scale. Towns and villages are easily conquered. A week in Vion was enough to walk every path, to learn every face, but with cities like Paris, London, Chicago, New York, she doesn't have to pace herself. Doesn't have to take small bites to make the newness last. A city she can consume as hungrily as she likes, devour it every day, and never run out of things to eat. It is the kind of place that takes years to visit, and still there always seems to be another alley, another set of steps, another door. Perhaps that's why she hasn't noticed it before. Set off from the curb and down a short flight of steps, there was a shop half hidden by the line of the street. The awning was clearly once purple, but has long faded toward gray, though the shop's name is still legible, picked out in white lettering. The Last Word. A used bookstore, judging by the name, and the windows brimming with stacked spines. Addie's pulse thrills a little. She was certain she'd found them all. But that is the brilliant thing about New York. Addie has wandered a fair portion of the five boroughs, and still the city has its secrets, some tucked in corners, basement bars, speakeasies, members-only clubs, and others sitting in plain sight. Like Easter eggs in a movie, the ones you don't notice until the second or third viewing. And not like Easter eggs at all, because no matter how many times she walks these blocks, no matter how many hours or days or years she spends learning the contours of New York, as soon as she turns her back, it seems to shift again, reassemble. Buildings go up and come down, businesses open and close, people arrive and depart, and the deck shuffles itself again and again and again. Of course, she goes in. A faint bell announces her arrival, the sound quickly smothered by the crush of books in various conditions. Some bookstores are organized, more gallery than shop. Some are sterile, reserved for only the new and untouched. But not this one. This shop is a labyrinth of stacks and shelves, texts stacked two, even three deep, leather beside paper beside board. Her favorite kind of store, one that's easy to get lost in. There is a checkout counter by the door, but it is empty, and she wanders unmolested through the aisles, picking her way along the well-loved shelves. The bookshop seems fairly empty, save for an older white man studying a row of thrillers, a gorgeous black girl sitting cross-legged in a leather chair at the end of a row, silver shining on her fingers and in her ears, a giant art book open in her lap. Addie wanders past a placard marked poetry, and the darkness whispers against her skin, teeth skimming like a blade along a bare shoulder. "Come live with me and be my love." Addie's refrain, worn smooth with repetition, "You do not know what love is." She doesn't stop, but turns the corner, fingers trailing now along theology. She has read the Bible, the Upanishads, the Quran, after a spiritual bender of sorts a century ago. She passes Shakespeare, too, a religion all his own. She pauses at memoir. Studying the titles on the spines, so many I's and me's and my's, possessive words for possessive lives. What a luxury to tell one story, to be read, remembered. Something knocks against Addie's elbow, and she looks down to see a pair of amber eyes peering over her sleeve, surrounded by a mass of orange fur. The cat looks as old as the book in her hand. It opens its mouth and lets out something between a yawn and a meow, a hollow whistling sound. "Hello." She scratches the cat between the ears, eliciting a low rumble of pleasure. "Wow," says a male voice behind her. "Book doesn't usually bother with people." Addie turns, about to comment on the cat's name, but loses her train of thought when she sees him. Because for a moment, only a moment, before the face comes into focus, she is certain it is... But it is not him. Of course it is not. The boy's hair, though black, falls in loose curls around his face, and his eyes, behind their thick frame glasses, are closer to gray than green. There is something fragile to them, more like glass than stone, and when he speaks, his voice is gentle, warm, undeniably human. "Help you find anything?" Addie shakes her head. "No," she says, clearing her throat. "Just browsing."
"Well then," he says with a smile, "carry on."
She watches him go, black curls vanishing into the maze of titles, before dragging her gaze back to the cat. But the cat is gone too. Addie returns the memoir to the shelf and continues browsing, attention wandering over art and world history, all the while waiting for the boy to reappear, to start the cycle over, wondering what she'll say when he does. She should have asked for help, let him lead her through the shelves, but he doesn't come back. The shop bell chimes again, announcing a new customer as Addie reaches the classics: Beowulf, Antigone, The Odyssey. There are a dozen versions of this last, and she's just drawing one out when there's a sudden burst of laughter, high and light, and she glances through a gap in the shelves and sees a blonde girl leaning on the counter. The boy stands on the other side, cleaning his glasses on the edge of his shirt. He bows his head, dark lashes skimming his cheeks. He isn't even looking at the girl, who's rising on her toes to get closer to him. She reaches out and runs one hand along his sleeve, the way Addie just did along the shelves, and he smiles then, a quiet, bashful grin that erases the last of his resemblance to the dark. Addie tucks the book under her arm and heads for the door and out, taking advantage of his distraction. "Hey," calls a voice, his voice, but she continues up the steps onto the street. In a moment, he will forget. In a moment, his mind will trail off and he'll... A hand lands on her shoulder. "You have to pay for that." She turns, and there's the boy from the shop, a little breathless and very annoyed. Her eyes flick past him to the steps, the open door. It must have been ajar. He must have been right behind her. But still, he followed her out.
Well?
He demands, hand dropping from her shoulder and coming to rest, palm open in the space between them. She could run, of course, but it's not worth it. She checks the cost on the back of the book. It isn't much, but it's more than she has on her.
Sorry, she says, handing it back.
He frowns then, a furrow too deep for his face, the kind of line carved by years of repetition, even though he can't be more than 30. He looks down at the book, and a dark brow lifts behind his glasses.
A shop full of antique books, and you steal a battered paperback of the Odyssey? You know this won't fetch anything, right?
Addie holds his gaze.
Who says I wanted to resell it?
It's also in Greek.
That she hadn't noticed. Not that it matters. She learned the classics in Latin first, but in the decades since, she's picked up Greek.
Silly me, she says dryly. I should have stolen it in English.
He almost smiles then, but it's a bemused, misshapen thing. Instead, he shakes his head.
Just take it, he says, holding out the book. I think the shop can spare it.
She has to fight the sudden urge to push it back. The gesture feels too much like charity.
Henry,
calls the pretty black girl from the doorway.
Should I call the cops? No,
he calls back, still looking at Addie.
It's fine.
He narrows his eyes as if studying her.
Honest mistake.
She stares at this boy, at Henry. Then she reaches out and takes back the book, cradling it against her, as the bookseller vanishes back into the shop.